people are always late and always complain. Those people always think others are to blame. Your people think they should be the first in line. Those people always do the time. People, those people, they argue.
Hey there and welcome. We're going to start off as we always do, and thank you out there for checking out this episode of Those People, a podcast about people with people. As usual, I'm your host, Mitch Gaines. You can find me at Mitch Gaines just about anywhere on the internet that I want to be found. If this is your first time checking out the show, thank you, thank you, thank you. We are so happy to have you. I should note that this is kind of a unique episode, a little bit of a bonus episode, so if you're looking for some of our more profile-esque interviews, if you will, feel free to go back and check out some of our other episodes. Those People is a show, as I mentioned, with people about people, where we explore all the labels that other people give us and the ones that we give ourselves. So every episode we sit down with a different guest, and typically we'll interview them about their stories, their successes, their struggles, all the important S words really. But most importantly, we kick it with them about the people who are involved in those stories. If you love it, we'd love you to go out and go tell a friend. If you hate it, we hate you, and please kindly shut the fuck up forever. I am just kidding about that last part, but if you hate the show for real, please shoot me a note at mitchgaines@gmail.com. Tell me what you hated, and we'll try and do a little bit better next time. As always, I also want to take a quick second here to remind all of you who do love the show, or just some of those people that we've had on the show, to please subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen. It really helps other people discover the show. Platforms we are currently on include Stitcher, Anchor, Pocket Cast, a new sponsor, Spotify, my personal favorite, Radio Public, and a whole bunch more. If you happen to be a Pod Chaser or an Apple listener and you really like the show, it'd mean a lot to us if you could go out and rate and review the podcast, but only if you like the show. Save the hate takes for Twitter, where again you can find me at Mitch Gaines. That's Gaines with a Y because I'm a little bit gay. G-A-Y-N-S. I'm joined on the show today by my very special guest, Ryan Grimm. He is the DC bureau chief for The Intercept. He's a contributor over at The Young Turks, who and he most recently wrote the story on Pete Buttigieg's, shall we say, politely questionable black outreach in South Carolina. And so as a person of color who supports Pete Buttigieg and has been following his campaign and also somewhat critical of his black outreach, I want to sit down with Ryan and talk a little bit more about that story. So without much further ado, welcome to the show, Ryan.
Oh, thanks for having me.
appreciate you coming on and kind of being on the other side of this with me. A lot of my following is Pete people for sure, so I'm excited sure. to kind of get the opposing
well,
perspective
there's
for
a change. There's a lot to like about Pete, so I don't think that your people are crazy if that's where they are.
Awesome. So I want to start off this episode. As I mentioned, this is kind of a unique episode for us, but I would want to start off in a familiar place and something we do with every guest here, which is I ask for a conversational safe word. So in the age of consent we live in here, I ask everybody to give me a safe word, not dissimilar to a sexual safe word, where if I ask anything that's off limits, anything that's out of bounds, you say that safe word, I will shut the fuck up. We'll move on to another area of the conversation. Much like your sexual safe word, if you have to use it like 15 times within like an hour, then we're probably having a bad time here. Political revolution. Okay. I feel like that may come up in other contexts, but all right, we'll go with that. the other thing I usually do to start off here, just to get a little kind of background on everybody, is where are you from originally? Like, where did you grow up? Where are you from?
I grew up on the eastern shore of Maryland. Have you ever been over there?
I have not. So I've traveled a good bit of the country, but Maryland somehow I've missed entirely so far.
It's a very rural part of Maryland. It's on the eastern, they call it the Eastern Shore because it's on the eastern end of the Chesapeake Bay. It's kind of a pocket of the South that's kind of, even though it's only about an hour south of Philadelphia where I grew up. It used to be, when I was growing up, it was very conservative and rural area and poor. There are now more developments coming from people who are commuting, I guess, to Wilmington and Philadelphia and Annapolis and elsewhere. And so it's starting to trend like a lot of the country more democratic. As those developments pop up, they tend to become filled with kind of college educated commuters who then vote Democratic. But so, yeah, I grew up on the Eastern Shore of Maryland, went to a public school down in Southern Maryland. And I've been in D.C. since 2002 or so.
Oh, wow. So you are the DC insider we read and hear about. You've actually been there your entire life.
I am now, yeah. I mean, if you count College Park, I went to grad school at University of Maryland College Park.
Go Terps.
And that is about, there you go, Fear the Turtle. It's about half a mile inside the Beltway.
All right.
So you could call it inside the, you could literally call it inside the Beltway. And so I've been around the area then since, yeah.
And just out of curiosity, what'd you go to school for? Did you go to school for journalism, or are you a poli-sci guy or philosophy or something like that?
I did, yep, philosophy at St. Mary's College in Maryland. And then I did my graduate work was in public policy,
which okay,
kind
cool.
of a focus on environmental policy. That, you know, 2002, like when, at that time, the, you know, Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth was out, the hockey stick graphs were out, like, I don't, how old are you?
I'm 29, coming up on 30 in the spring.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm 41. And like, so by my early 20s, like it was extremely clear that we were facing a complete cataclysmic wall, you know, civilizational wall, if we did not do something about climate change. And so I did environmental policy as my graduate work. And here we are, we have done basically nothing in the intervening years.
Well, I thank you at least for getting the knowledge to be able to have the debate that everybody's ready to have now, 20 years later.
Yeah, you tried.
And so I'm curious, obviously, because I wanted to have you on about this Buttigieg story. What was coming from kind of an environmental justice and kind of, I guess I would say, class consciousness point of perspective? How did you start covering kind of race relations and politics in general? And kind of like the people side of it, if you will.
I probably came at it through drug policy and criminal justice reform. But also, you know, if you grow up in a fairly poor southern kind of environment, you're going to come across a lot of kind of integration in a way that you don't perhaps in wealthier liberal areas. And that might be kind of confusing to people who might think that, well, I thought it's the South who are the racists and it's the Northerners who are, well, those are the woke folks. But in fact, in a lot of Southern areas, the kids who are growing up, you know, have thoroughly integrated working class, multiracial working class friend groups. And the other thing is that I don't know if people understand this, but police in rural areas treat poor white people just absolutely horribly. Not as bad as they treat poor black people, but they completely dehumanize poor white people. And the fights between, you know, the conflict between poor white people and police in rural areas are famous in those areas, but they don't really penetrate the kind of media narrative about American history or American culture. And so I always kind of had an affinity for criminal justice reform, drug policy reform, and racial exploitation at the hands of like a violent police force. And so I've been covering race relations, even though I'm a white person, you know, basically since I got into journalism.
My first guest ever on this show was Brianna Wu, who's, you know, a Gamergate activist. She's running for House up in my home state here in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. One of the things she and I spoke about was she grew up in Mississippi, and this idea that, like, all white people, especially white people in the North, must just be, like, so distant and out of touch with black culture. And it's like, the South is the blackest part of America. Like, you did not grow up under,
right,
you know, $100,000 a year or so as a white person south of the Mason-Dixon line and not interact with black people. You know, I mean, that's a much more common thing up here where, like, you know, in my high school, I was one of six black people in the entire school. Like, a lot of people had never met a black person before meeting me. Like, that was a right, common thing here.
Right. Yeah, yeah. So, you get it. Yeah, it's different worlds.
A little bit. And so you said, obviously, a lot of your initial coverage was kind of through the drug war era and kind of from the criminal justice side of things. I guess I can start there with Pete, because one of the things that was kind of critiqued in your story was not just necessarily the rollout here, but the plan itself of the Douglas plan. And one of the areas I found that plan to be strong enough for me, actually, was in the kind of criminal justice area, and specifically on drug reform, and his plans to decriminalize most drugs, completely federally decriminalize marijuana, expunge everybody's records, apply those retroactively. A lot of the kind of like left progressive policies I've been wanting to see from more people. And so from that perspective, that seems I don't know. I don't want to set you up too bad here, but I guess like I would imagine you came into looking at the plan like, hey, this is a good thing.
Yeah. There's a lot to like in that plan, and I think if that plan were executed, I think the world would be a better place. I actually agree with that. I think you can definitely quibble with it at the margins. If that's even my place, if you start to get into it, there's some silly stuff here and there. Like if you went to college on Pell Grants and you later start a business that later employs at least three people, then you'll get some student loan forgiveness.
That's probably like, one of my more critiqued portions of the plan. It resembles Kamala Harris's student debt reduction plan. And I was like, there's a lot of hoops to jump through here.
Yeah. Come on. I got to hire three people. I guess, by then you're probably can handle your loans. That's not the person who needs it.
I would hope. And only for I would hope you're not employing people and you're still $100,000 in the hole, personally.
Yeah. But in general, seemed like a strong and good faith effort. Particularly on that front. And I also very much appreciate, I think Buttigieg is excellent as a white person in the way he talks about race. And I very much appreciate the way that he's always quick to say, look, the beginning and end of the reach out to the black community cannot be criminal justice reform. Like, yes, it's important. And it's an animating issue, but there's so much more to the question than just that. And there's something almost racist if you just narrow it simply to criminal justice reform. And so he's good at both having a very strong criminal justice reform package and also being quite clear and explicit that is not enough.
I would agree. I think one of the things that drew me to him in general is just that is, as I mentioned, I grew up around a lot of white people. And so, I'm biracial. I have a tough time believing, every white person is never to be trusted and they're all a little bit racist, even though, my life experience has proven that out to be probably more true than not. So I looked at Pete and I was like, well, he's young enough to be malleable. So if he doesn't know any better, then at least like he's not rigid in his positions. And the way he speaks about it is the verbiage of somebody who wants to help, even if he gets some of the details wrong. And so that was kind of my initial draw to him. Some of the flaws I kind of see in his candidacy are mostly more about message than they are policy. And so that's why your story in particular really caught my eye, because it highlighted a lot of the issues that I've seen come up around his candidacy. And, some I agree with and some I don't. But it kind of gave the opportunity to see all of those in one place. And so I guess I want to start with the most damning of them, I guess, in my opinion, is this idea of kind of the misleading identification of the support of the Douglas plan in South Carolina. So this op-ed comes out in the Carolinian. I hope I'm pronouncing that right as a northerner, Yankee accent here. Essentially highlighting 400 plus endorsers of the plan, not necessarily Pete himself. I thought that was relatively clear. Making certainly some broad sweeping identifications of it being primarily black support. Nowhere in that release did it say that they were all black supporters, but I went through and I think every time the number 400 or 400 plus is mentioned, it's either in a sentence with or adjacent to a sentence with noting the black support of the plan. So that was certainly like the intent, in my opinion, or at least how I received it. Reading your story, it sounds like that was not necessarily the makeup of that support. Can you speak a little bit to that just right. so we can kind of set the table here?
Yeah. So that turned out not to be the case. And so we, in South Carolina, where there's, you know, they have a long history of voter suppression, they ask, you know, you can self-identify racially on your voter registration form. So you can, you know, look somebody up in the voter file to see if they're identify as white or black. And so we went through that list, and indeed, you know, the top three, you know, it's a column that's written by three people who are three prominent black leaders in South Carolina. And then if you go through the top of the list, it's clear that it's led by black leaders, the top couple dozen or so. But then you start getting into more of it, and you start finding a bunch of white folks. And so there were, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but there were a significant number of people that we just simply couldn't find on the voter file. But of the ones we could, like more than half of those were white. And so even if you add in the ones that we couldn't find in the voter file and assume that every single one of those was black, then at least 44% or so of the list was white people. Which I kind of buried that piece a bit in the story because, you know, the campaign said, look, you know, we want multiracial support for this plan. It's only going to be implemented if it has a multiracial coalition behind it. And I agree with that. Like, I think you want, you're not going to pass it through Congress with only black support. I think that's clear. And so I kind of gave them a little bit of the benefit of the doubt on that one and put that part further down in the piece. But then after the story came out, they provided me with the email that they had sent to the 400 people. And in the email, it explicitly describes the list as 400 black South Carolinians, giving people an option to opt out of endorsing it. And so your read on the intent of that list to be read as 400 black South Carolinians was the same read I had. And then that email kind of confirmed it. And I felt a little bit burned. I'm like, all right, this whole time you guys were saying that you never intended this whatsoever to be anything other than multiracial, but that clearly internally, that's not what you were intending. And what you were intending is what people took from it. Like in the Washington Post, when they wrote about it, they described it as hundreds of black supporters.
That's one of the parts, yeah, I found interesting was that I assumed to be the entry point for a lot of people, right? Like people aren't reading the Carolinian in California, but they may be reading the Washington Post. And so the way it was picked up and covered, I have to assume they had some hand in making sure like that was the narrative that surrounded that push. And then I saw that email and I was left kind of felt similar to you, maybe more so as a black person, like a little slapped in the face, like, okay, I'm on board with the multicultural coalition here, but what exactly was your intent? And so the campaign has apologized. They've said there was a staffer error. I don't know if that staffer is even still with the team anymore or not. I haven't been able to confirm that or not. But I guess I'm left wondering, like, is that just, you know, one overzealous staffer who's like, hey, our black numbers are terrible, and like I'm trying to be a good white ally here, and like this is, you know, this is how they taught me how to do it at, you know, whatever Ivy League institute I went to or whatever consulting job I had before this? Or is that something different?
I mean, if it was a staffer error, it was a completely understandable one because the entire, like you said, the entire implication that the campaign was trying to give off was that this was 400 black South Carolinians. So either the staffer was in on the con or he or she was conned himself, and just took the campaign's implication at face value and made it explicit in the email. But it must have been funny for the 200 white people who got that email that said that they were, if they didn't opt out by 4 p.m., they were endorsing along with 400 black South Carolinians, a plan. Did none of those white people write back and say, hey, you might be a little confused here?
I was curious about that one myself. As not a single one of those white people has come forward, from my knowledge, on the record anywhere to be like, hey, like, I got and saw that email and like wrote back and was like, hey, I'm opting out of this. So like, as far as from where I'm sitting, I'm looking at the campaign almost like, okay, like this could have been an error. This could have been intentional, either or. But it says an awful lot about your supporters that you had 150, 200, whatever the number is, white people who got that email. Was like, nah, I'm cool with being misidentified as black for the sake of like this argument,
Pete,
I guess.
The cause of Pete. And well, what I had heard is that the plan was passed around at some Pete events. And people were asked to sign up as supporters of it, which would explain why there are some names on the list that appear to be made up. Because you know, if you're asked to sign something at an event, you're going to, you know, 1% of people is going to like write Mickey Mouse.
Oh, for sure. I think I write a fake name like 45% of the time.
Right. So they were at a Pete event. So that list of 400 is drawn like primarily from Pete supporters. But yeah, it's odd that apparently none of them wrote back and were like, hey, I think you're confused here. Email here says 400 black South Carolinians. I'm not that. But
and to that point, even I would imagine, you know, a lot of them already being Pete supporters, it's just another Pete email in their inbox, right? Like you get 400 fundraising emails a day.
That?
Like
right.
I'm sure a lot of them just glanced right over that and put that one in the spam folder.
Right.
I want to move on to a couple other bits you had in the story that I guess I'm a bit more critical on. I'm curious for your perspective on. So one of the things you led the story with was the anecdote that's been around since the summer or so of that viral video clip of Pete Buttigieg saying, I'm not here for your vote to a grieving woman who just after the Eric Logan shooting. And I've watched that video at least 400 times in my life at this point. Every single time I look at it, and it's like, this woman is grieving. She's clearly upset and clearly angry, rightfully so. She says, you're not getting my vote. And his response is like, I'm not here for your vote today. Like, that's not the capacity in which I'm here. I'm here, like, as your mayor to answer questions representing the city, to try and offer some condolence or some compassion. And, like, that's the capacity in which I'm here. I'm hard pressed to understand why this narrative is still out there that like somehow that was the wrong thing to say, because I can't imagine saying anything else in that scenario. You know, I can't imagine what exactly the better phrasing for that moment was.
Yeah, no, I kind of agree with you on that. And it's we mentioned it in the context of the optics that he's having problems with the black community, because it has become this, like you said, it's become this data point, and perception becomes reality, as you know too well. I did really quickly before we pivot off the South Carolina situation. To me, the list of 400 was that was one thing, but to me, far more powerful to me was what happened to Johnny Cordero and Ivory Thigpen, and to a lesser extent to Tamika Devine. Johnny Cordero is not just the guy who showed up at a Pete event. He's the chairman of the South Carolina Black Caucus, a very big deal in South Carolina. Thigpen is a well-known pastor and a state representative, a leader in the black community in South Carolina. Tamika Devine is a councilwoman from Columbia, South Carolina. And so both Cordero and Thigpen explicitly told the Buttigieg campaign, not just that they weren't endorsing the Buttigieg campaign, but that they did not want to endorse the Douglas plan itself. They had their own reasons why they didn't want to do that. And then they see the column published in the paper, and they are listed as two of the three bylines on this press release and on this publication. And try to think for a second if a politician or a campaign would make a, let's call it a mistake, would make a mistake like that, that toward any race other than black officials. Like, can you imagine a white state representative in Iowa having his name just put onto a campaign's policy agenda when that white state representative had said that they're not endorsing that.
I'll respond to that first, and then I want to go back to kind of the individual instances with Cordero and Thigpen. Short answer, yes, I could definitely imagine that. Specifically in the case of women, actually, is I could see a very similar scenario where, you know, something gets passed around at some, you know, a women's march event or some similar rally, and then a bunch of names get attached to something, and then people who opted out getting overlooked.
But that's not what happened here. Pete himself sent Cordero. This was like a high level lobbying effort where Pete himself sent the plan.
Like I said, I want to respond to the two individual cases kind of separately. But as far as like, could I see that happening in other instances? Certainly.
I agree with you. I agree with you on that.
As far as the situation with Cordero, from my understanding, from your reporting and some of the others I've read, and I haven't had a chance to speak with him personally. I'd try to reach out, but as you might imagine, he's a hard guy to get hold of. His major issue with it was not necessarily with the plan, but with who exactly were authoring it, and I guess for lack of a better phrasing here, like their authority to speak on behalf of Black America. That's a criticism I've heard since the day I read the Douglas plan, and I've heard from a lot of people, and I think they've done a really bad job kind of identifying the authorship of the plan. Beyond that, my understanding was that he mostly supported what was in the plan, but he felt uncomfortable attaching his name to it without knowing who was behind the plan. Is that about right?
That's correct.
Okay. So I still don't know how his name gets attached in that article. I agree with you there. I have to imagine it was some level of miscommunication there where they thought they provided him the answers he was looking for, and so they were good to go. But that one definitely stands out to me because I, as somebody who supports the plan, struggled to get those answers myself for a while. I'm happy to report I've gotten those answers. The original authorship team was a team of 11. It was roughly 40% Black. Then they took that out to 40-plus Black heads of industry and different kind of community organizations, as well as doctors and educators, as well as, you know, naturally for Pete, some mayors, and kind of shopped that around to them and their extended networks. And then once they finalized the plan, took that through a bunch of different Black community leaders more on the ground, whether that's, you know, state reps, city councils, you know, teachers unions, things of that nature, to get feedback. Having gotten those answers, that seemed pretty clear to me. I don't know if maybe, like you said, that was a very high level courting effort. I don't know if they had a similar conversation with him and they were like, okay, like we felt after that conversation that was like a yes. So that one is a little more defensible to me. The Thigpen one is the part I still lack clarity on. I'm hoping maybe you can give me some context on, because he's the state chair of Bernie's campaign. I don't think it's any secret, and I'm a Bernie and a Pete supporter, so it breaks my heart. But it's no secret that Bernie people aren't exactly endorsing Pete anytime soon. So that one I'm struggling to kind of grasp.
Yeah, he was like, look, he didn't get into the details, but he said he had some problems with particular elements of the plan. And he said, look, I'd be happy to give you guys a quote that says, and I've seen these quotes before, you've seen them before, that says, like, I applaud, Pete's willingness to have the important conversations that we need to have. It's favorable. It's like, I like this guy, but it's like, you know, setting some distance. Like, I'm not endorsing everything he's doing here, but I'm glad that he's moving in this direction.
Which is essentially, don't put my name on the byline, but like, if you want a quote and like, you feel like my voice is important, like you're a good enough guy, I'll give you a thumbs up.
Right. And then they never circled back to like get that quote. And he thought that it was just dropped because that wasn't what they were looking for. You know, they wanted like a full on endorsement of the plan. And so he just moved on from there. And then all of a sudden he starts getting calls. I'm like, hey, saw you in the paper. I don't know if that sheds much more light onto it. Not really. I have known Liz Smith for years. And I'm a fan of hers. I think she's an extraordinary communicator and a great strategist. And obviously she has done historic work in like building the South Bend mayor into a very credible presidential candidate. But, you know, with all of these things, that your strengths that often become your weaknesses, you know, there's a bravado and a recklessness to the barreling forward. And I this is not from any recording I have, but I could just imagine a kind of fuck it, do it live kind of approach to the rolling out of the Douglas plan. But it's a pushing of the envelope. It's a kind of an aggressive approach that is in many ways responsible for the surge, but it's going to get you caught up sometimes too.
I think one of the tricky parts about Pete's black outreach for me is that, to your point, his whole campaign is built on, as I've termed it with my friends, the Liz Smith brand of bravado. It's like, it's this, you know, it's bravado for 2020. It's, you know, both demure and confident. It's both like a little snarky and witty, but like with a sassiness that lands with women. Like it's a lot of the way in which he communicates is built for this new era, but it is built on something of a recklessness that's inherent to our era, right? There's something about the idea that you will forget what happened, you know, 4 hours ago, because right. That's the time we live in.
Yep.
And I think
no,
part of,
I think, yeah.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I think you're right. I think it's well put.
I think part of the issue, though, is then that doesn't land well with black communities for a lot of reasons, right? You have, I kind of split the older and the younger black community, but you have the older black community where Pete's message has been very well received for the older white community, right? But the older black community is, A, far less trusting of random white people, and to them, like, he's a strange white man from the middle of America saying he's got the literal comprehensive plan to save their community, right? Mm-hmm. I'd be skeptical of that, too. The older black people are certainly, just like older white people, more conservative and more homophobic. But then his targeting needs to kind of be that younger black voting demographic, and continuously his tone is one, yeah, I understand your importance, but I'm not really gonna, like, take the time to understand all the details I need to. And I think that I think that comes across more aggressive and condescending and intentional. And I'm lacking the correct word for it, but I guess it feels a lot worse than I think it does for his white voters, who view that as, oh, like, you're one of us. You're able to kind of joke around and maneuver around these different positions. And, like, I trust you're like us, so this is okay. And I think that's kind of part of where his communication's fallen short with black audiences.
Yes, and I think you have to couple that with the fact that he's starting, for whatever reason, already, as you alluded to, with a huge deficit among young people broadly, white, black, and brown. And so, you know, if you look at his white numbers of, you know, 18 to mid-20s or 30, they're in the basement as well. And so the same way that Bernie Sanders struggled with the black vote in 2016, he was able to make inroads with the young black voters significantly because he was making such huge inroads, you know, with young white voters. You know, it was more generational than it was racial. And so he's starting with that generational problem where,
well, and I think part of his issue there, right, is Bernie's placement in the campaign, right? Like, young people will continue to be drawn to Bernie because his ideas are better for them. You know what I mean? Like, that's just factual.
Right.
And so it's a little difficult to compete with younger voters. And I think part of that lead that Bernie's built around young black voters is exactly that, where that generation of younger voters who probably is a little more altruistic, a little more engaged with kind of the issues of the working class and of the poor, which, you know, is majority, you know, young people make up a good chunk of that. I don't think Pete's message necessarily lands with them like it does with the working poor, the union jobs who are, you know, being demoted in some sense as far as status and obviously in terms of benefits and pay. And I think his message is a little more resonant to those people who've been in the workforce, you know, 8, 10, 12, 15, 20 years, rather than those people who are getting into the workforce or maybe not even there quite yet.
Yeah, well, that sounds right. So, yeah, so he's already at a deficit and he hasn't really been able to close it.
I do have to ask you about one last thing here before we wrap up on a more optimistic note. And I just need to know this as somebody, so I'm not a professional journalist. I do not pretend to be. I'm just another hack pundit on the internet. But my full-time life, I'm mostly a marketing guy. And a lot of what I do is, you know, website design and things of that nature. And I saw you tack on the bit about the stock photography to this story. And I, with all due respect, I'm just trying to figure that out because this is a really strong story. I think like there's a lot of good criticism in here as somebody who is a supporter of Pete and like wants to bring up these criticisms often. This gives me like a leg to stand on in a lot of places. And like, I was really pumped for this article. And then you tack on the stock photography thing, which just seems like a non-story to me. Like, dude built a website with a handful of like contractors early on, and they threw in some stock photography. It was literally like if you go on Pexels and you search black mothers, it's the first photo that comes up. I'm 98% certain that's what happened. They were just like, we need a black person and their child. Black mothers. That looks good. Crop. And that doesn't seem like the largest offense in politics to me.
Yeah, and you know what? I kind of regret that tweet that went internationally viral and made news in Kenya. And I think part of it is I've had my Twitter account since 2007 or whatever, and I still think of it, even though I'm like 90,000 followers or whatever it is now, I still think of it as like a place to tell jokes with my friends.
It's still Twitter, right?
You know what I mean? It's still Twitter. And I need to reorient my understanding of the platform as it has evolved and as I've evolved, and to understand that it's not just jokes with my friends. Like if I want to tell a joke among my friends, I got to email my friends or DM my friends or whatever.
The email newsletter is back just for this focus.
Yeah, exactly. I could have put it in there, although I have a big newsletter, which is called Bad News. People should subscribe, so that might still have gone viral from there. I did not include it in the story. I never added it like as an update to the story. I just kind of thought it was funny.
Oh, it's definitely funny. I had a great fucking laugh at it. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah, it's good. But I have been frustrated that it became the thing. Kamala got asked about it at the debate. And then the campaign kind of latched on to it and made its apology for that.
That's a lot easier to apologize for, right?
Yeah, sure. Sorry. Our fault. We'll take the photo out and put in a new photo. Our apologies. For all of those reasons, I kind of regret it. And I don't know, we can't know whether the media would have been either forced to focus on the black officials, or whether the media just would have ignored the story totally. So it's not, we don't know how that would have played out. Like maybe the only way they were ever going to even show any interest in the story was this stock photo. And like, I just was shaking my head as the New York Times and the Washington Post like wrote headlines about this stock photo, which I didn't consider relevant enough to even include in the article itself. I'm the responsible party. I'm the one who posted it up on Twitter and kicked the whole thing off. So, it's definitely something to think about. And I would not disagree with the point that you're making, but man, how do you sit on a joke like that?
I mean
it's just so.
Twitter Twitter gets the best of us all sometimes, I think. I certainly started my Twitter account as somewhat of like a comedian, and Twitter is very much still that place for me to just be like a snarky asshole on the internet. And now, and like you said, as the follower count grows, more and more people look to you as like, hey, like you're a real person I need to like pay attention to and hang on your every word. And I'm like, I'm not that guy, man. Like I'm that guy professionally, but that's not my Twitter account.
Right. Apparently it is.
All right. So I want to wrap up here and ask, I guess, on a more optimistic note, as somebody who, I guess, in my ideal scenario, right, as we trim this field, we get down to some scenario where it's like Bernie, Warren, and Pete. And I'm like, if the furthest right we can go is Pete Buttigieg, awesome. I can live with that. What would be kind of like your recommendation to Pete as far as like his communication to black voters? And like, do you think it's salvageable? Like, do you think he can win over black voters?
The first thing I would advise him is not to ask me. If he's asking me, he's in trouble. but if he insists,
you seem to have more black friends than most of his campaign staff, so maybe you're a good guy to ask.
I mean, I would just say, you know, be authentic, be yourself. Don't be afraid of yourself. Just be who you are and trust in the good faith and the wisdom of the black community to identify and create an authentic connection. If it's not there, do not degenerate into anti-blackness or blame the black community for not coming around, because that could be a risk that you start to resent the black community or start to resent black voters for spurning you. So don't be a spurned lover, because then you're just going to start to do stuff that appears driven by animus or hostility. And then it just spirals out of control. I don't know. What have you advised them?
I would mostly agree with that. I think he's done a pretty good job kind of with the authenticity, but I think part of the issue of authentic Pete is like authentic Pete is a little awkward around black people from what I can tell. You know what I mean? Like it's clearly authentically like new to him. But also like, I think just lean into that somewhat and like be okay with that and be like, hey, like I am new to this. I am trying to do the right thing, but a lot of this is going to be me listening to you. So like, I want everybody at the table. I think that's mostly been his message so far, but as more pundits than me have pointed out, I don't think the early states lend themselves to like that being a big part of your message early on. And I think where he struggles obviously is being the most unknown in the black community. It comes across like he's intentionally ignoring them as he's on the rise, you know, in these very white states of Iowa and New Hampshire. And he's like, yeah, I'll get around to you guys when I come to South Carolina. And, you know, you have black people like me who, you know, live 20 minutes from the New Hampshire border. And I'm like, hey man, like we're up here too. And so I think he's fighting a war on a lot of different fronts as far as the exposure thing. But like you said, I think as long as he stays authentic and continues to grow his team, like he raised enough money, so I'm sure he can afford to hire the people, kind of grow his team and grow his outreach. I think he'll be all right. And I think more and more of our community will come around on him the more and more that they hear from him and understand that, as you said at the top, his plans and his heart and his intent is all in the right place. And a lot of the things he's coming up short on are most of the things people point out already. His lack of experience in his youth. And I think those are strengths, not weaknesses, when it comes to white people talking about race. Like, I'd rather have somebody who's 37 and figuring it out than somebody who's 55 and decided what they believe in.
Well, the good news is he can only go up from here.
Exactly, right? We're on the upward trajectory.
Yeah, and he can start to tout doubling and tripling of numbers if he can, you know, move from like 1 to 2 or 1 to 3.
Hey, I saw a poll recently. He was all the way up at 6. He's at 14 in an Iowa poll with non-white voters, which, like, I don't know how many people that is. It's probably like 12 people or whatever. But, like, slowly but surely, he's creepy.
Hey, there you go.
All right. Well, I will end this episode as I always do. I want to thank you for coming on to this episode and joining us here on Those People. The last question I always ask everybody is who do you hope hears this interview? Who do you hope kind of hears this story? Here's the clarification there on the stock photo controversy so we can get that over and done with. Like, who are you hoping kind of stumbles across this?
Well, I'm glad to talk to Pete supporters. So I do think that, You're the best ally of a candidate if your eyes wide open about strengths and weaknesses, and also you know, just the broad Democratic coalition. You know, ultimately, you know, there's a bigger war that's going to be waged pretty soon.
Well, if you are a Pete supporter out there, or you're just part of that broad Democratic coalition, or even if you're a Republican and you're thinking about swinging on over and joining us, whoever you are, I know you're out there listening because everybody listens to the Those People's podcast. So be sure to check out Ryan Grimm. He's the D.C. Bureau Chief of The Intercept. He's a contributor at the Young Turks. Where can they find you, Ryan? Where's the best place to find you?
Yeah, I guess Twitter if you want jokes. Intercept is where I do my writing and reporting, and there will be a link there to my new book, which is about the kind of insurgent movement, and includes Pete's run for DNC chair, actually.
All right.
And I think a lot of your listeners would probably learn a lot of the history of the last 30 years that has kind of led to this moment that we're in now.
And the name of the book for everybody out there is We've Got People. Is that correct?
We've Got People. From Jesse Jackson to AOC, basically.
All right. That's quite a range. I'm excited to check it out.
Yeah. 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 I think there's some real linkages there between those movements.
Well, I look forward to learning more about that. I will have to catch the audiobook when it comes out because I have about a stack of about 14 books I got to read in the next 6 weeks, so I got to get through those first. But thank you for listening out there at home. Please do make sure to check out the book, We've Got People. Check out all of Ryan's work at The Intercept. And his jokes on Twitter are pretty fucking funny, too, so you can check him out there. You can tweet me at Mitch Gaines, at MitchGayns. Keep the conversation going about any of what we talked about in this episode or any others. And we'll be back for the second half of this episode with Nina Smith later today. So make sure you check that out too. For Ryan Grimm, I am Mitch Gaines. We are all those people, and we'll talk to you next time. And we are back with the second half of our episode here with Nina Smith. Typically, we do this second half in a section called I'm One of Those People. We wrapped up our season on political people, but since we were back here with this lovely bonus episode, I guess we were going to do some more political people talking. And so I guess I want to start off with just kind of what kind of political person you are, because I feel like you mentioned earlier, a lot of people around the country don't pay enough attention to politics to exactly understand all the inner workings, and we're going to get a little bit in the weeds here. So I want to lay out for people sort of what is your role politically? Like, where do you see yourself as far as, you know, a political operative, if you will?
I mean, you know, for us PR folks in politics, we call ourselves Blacks. and so, you know, I mean, essentially I'm a political comms, professional. And in that regard, I mean, my firm is very mission based and oriented. It's a not for profit social justice PR firm called Megaphone Strategies. It is made up of, it's women run, majority women of color owned, majority LGBTQ, folks who are dedicated to, social justice in America. And so, we've had the opportunity to work with organizations who can afford top-notch PR services, and then organizations, we've done pro bono work and sliding scale work for organizations who are doing fantastic work and can't afford to have PR support. So, from a political standpoint, my view of the world and professionally what I try to do is make sure that stories are being told to elected officials, and that elected officials are telling the stories that need to be told when it comes to the policies that they're putting forward, decisions they're making, and how it impacts their constituents. And just believing very firmly that communication, that messaging, being clear and your intent and what you're trying to do is so critical, I think, to making any sort of progress towards, you know, justice and equality and all of those virtues that were promised in the founding of this country, but haven't necessarily been fulfilled.
And so I guess this may sound like a dumb question or an ignorant question, but like, what made you feel like you could really do that? Because we talked a little bit in the first half about sort of that imposter syndrome that sits in, especially as like a younger person. And like, when did you feel like, hey, like, no, I'm really doing this. Like, I can feel good about starting an agency. Like, I feel confident about making that leap. I feel like I'm here. I've arrived. I'm no longer questioning. I'm no longer feeling like an imposter.
It's interesting because, you know, I've moved from different spaces. Whether it's in government, outside government, you know, recognizing that there are different things to learn and pick up and to navigate. And then there are also different areas where, you know, you can push and advocate for change. And I've seen it happen in a number of different spaces, to some degree, some new discussion that we've started. Or when I was working for Governor O'Malley in Maryland and seeing that we moved 75,000 people off of cash assistant roles and moved them into jobs that paid at least $10 an hour. It's seeing those sorts of indicators of progress, those intangibles that people don't see on a day-to-day basis on like the macro level, but those wins, you know, meeting somebody who, you know, I may have helped move something that they were doing, like, you know, they're having trouble with their school or something along those lines, and then meeting them years later and seeing where they are, you know, or even my mentee who, one of my mentees who I met through a program I did when I was with the governor and, you know, stayed in touch with him. And now he's an entrepreneur, like selling his own clothing, has a kid, like it's a little... It's those little stories that make that kind of renew my faith and idealism in the process, because we do get those wins, you know.
I would certainly say so. And that sounds like that's going to be one of the more fulfilling feelings I could ever imagine, is seeing a wrong in the world and literally just advocating and using your voice and your message and all the ways in which, like, you know how to communicate best to change people's minds in such a way that the political consciousness of, you know, a city, a town, and a neighborhood, you know, a cul-de-sac even, like, changes their mind about something. That was definitely one of the most fulfilling feelings you can have, in my opinion. I guess I want to jump ahead a little bit and kind of get an understanding of where we're at now politically and, I guess, professionally. Obviously, you've been with Pete's campaign for quite a while now, pretty much as long as I've been following it. And most recently, and on the earlier half of this episode here, I spoke with Ryan Grimm regarding the Douglas Plan, which is, you know, one of the things that drew me to Pete, I think has drawn a lot of people to Pete and is a big portion of his message. I spoke with Ryan about a lot of, I guess, some of the miscommunications in rolling it out in certain places, but also what I believe to be some of the miscommunications with a lot of people about what's in the plan. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about kind of how a plan that expansive, that comprehensive, kind of gets written. Like, how does that get made? And so if you could just treat me like I'm an idiot here for a couple of minutes and sort of walk me through what is sort of the policy writing process for Team Pete. Like, how does one start the Douglas Plan?
You know, we have folks who are in the policy space who you know, volunteer their time to, you know, develop these things. And this is work that they do in their regular lives that allows for them to take some of their own personal time and work on it. And so it was myself, you know, understanding how a lot of government works with Bell, and I've had about 10 years of experience in government. And then, you know, a couple of other folks, Portia Allen and Chike Aga, who, you know, were kind of the chief folks behind the policy synthesis. And Pete, I think, initiated the conversation around thinking about some of the things that he had seen in South Bend, you know, how we could put together a package and an agenda for Black America. And this started in, I think we were talking about it and talking through it in May and June and finalizing the pieces. I mean, there were a lot of conference calls you know, to build up the framework, the basic pillars, you know, how we wanted to approach it, in that, you know, yes, this would be a comprehensive agenda, you know, understanding that, you know, the concerns of Black Americans will show up in other policy pieces, but, you know, we wanted this to kind of be very clear about the campaign's priorities and Pete's priorities when it came to improving the Black experience. And so we worked on it for several weeks. You know, put together the package, and then shopped it around Black activists, elected officials, you know, a number of folks who are engaged in activism around issues impacting Black America. And, you know, I would say something around, you know, at least 40 in the beginning. And, you know, as I mentioned and have mentioned, you know, we continue to shop it around. If people have feedback on it, you know, we're always willing to listen. It's a continuous work. And we even shopped it to folks in South Bend, making sure that they we had buy-in from them based on Pete's experience of South Bend as to some of the issues that needed to be addressed. And so we were very deliberate in, you know, starting the work. I mean, there was a core team, African-American women, you know, African-American men working on this piece. And then we shopped it around to get broader input. And if there were blind spots, we tried to ask people to point them out to us. And we've also done it in an outreach capacity, in that, you know, reaching out to the average person, presenting it to them, and, you know, seeing what they thought and getting their input. And that was part of the engagement we did in South Carolina, which was, you know, showing this plan, this comprehensive plan, to folks down there, getting their input and feedback on what we were doing, and, you know, seeing if they would be willing to, you know, if they approved of it, if they'd be willing to endorse it.
So I want to get to that in a second, but I guess I'm curious, how frequently is that kind of being shopped around at first? So we get through kind of that initial group, it's you, it's Chike, it's Portia, a couple other people maybe, and kind of conferencing in leaders and officials, and then by, you know, June or so, I believe, is when you guys have like that first version that comes out. You mentioned it sounds like there's kind of constant communication with, I would imagine, some of those initial people from those conference calls, that initial network, but also, you know, as we're traveling the country, meeting new people, shopping this around to regular people, and then also shopping this around to, you know, heads of cities, heads of, you know, different industries within smaller industries. I know I spoke with a state official out in Illinois who was one of the people who sat in on one of these panels. So how frequently are those happening between June and now? Because obviously they're still happening today. That's what this is.
Constantly, because, I mean, you know, our staff has grown. So now we're at a point where it's like, I don't think there's an aspect of the campaign organization that isn't talking to people about the Douglas plan and taking feedback, you know, but, you know, the majority of it was happening through our political departments and engagement departments. And I can't even put it into numbers, because, I mean, Pete is constantly meeting with people and talking to people about the Douglas plan, but it's typically not in like big flashy settings. It's in one-to-one meetings. It's off the record, you know, conversations we're having with folks. I mean, we had a few yesterday just in Atlanta. And so we're, you know, this isn't something where we're trying to like do it all in front of the cameras and make it really flashy and then not doing any of the work afterward. It's constant engagement and one-to-one, and then also in groups. And then also whenever we can do events, we'll do events around it. But that's generally, you know, it's an ongoing thing. I don't think it ever stops for us and has ever stopped for us.
There's a couple of things I guess I want to follow up on there. One of the things I'm kind of curious about is Pete, in my opinion, like one of the big appeals to Pete for me is him being a white man, and certainly being of the distinction of like, hey, I'm kind of over white men running our country, was his rhetoric is actively anti-racist. And, you know, growing up around a lot of white people, like, I know the type of rhetoric it takes from white people to other white people to change their minds about race. Like, I've watched it happen my entire life. My mother is white and a social worker, married to a black man. This was much of my childhood experience, is watching this happen. And so I think he does a great job of that, but also he sort of avoids the tonality of race neutrality, right, when he's out speaking. But a lot of the plan is from, as I read it anyway, intentionally race neutral or universal in a lot of concepts. Like criminal justice, for example, like you can't have criminal justice reform that's race specific. That wouldn't make sense, right? Like that's bad policy. But then there's other instances where I look at things like the HBCU funding that also includes another $25 billion for minority serving institutions. And I've gotten some pushback from people who are, you know, against the plan on this. And I've kind of come up in the middle. I'm not quite sure how I feel about it. But is there kind of a reason for the policy itself being race neutral or as universal as it can be, even though obviously you're getting constant input from Black leaders, you're constantly shopping this around to communities, and it's not like Black people don't want other people to have access to good lives, right? Like we want everybody to be helped as much as we can. But the plan is intentionally framed as this plan for Black America, and much of the policy isn't just Black specific. It's universal. It's intersectional. I guess those two things, it lines up with his kind of policies of belonging and inclusion and having everything be intersectional, and that all makes sense to me. But that doesn't exactly jibe with this idea of like, here is my plan for specifically you, and here's a bunch of things that aren't specific to you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I would disagree there.
Okay.
There's tell a plan. I would disagree that there the plan itself is very. I mean, HBCUs. MSIs and the like are included, but HBCUs are outlined in there very specifically. There's a plank around increasing knowledge around Black culture and the arts in there. There are a number of different things that speak exactly to the Black experience. So I'd be curious to figure out what the race neutral language you're talking about refers to. And
so for example, like something like securing an increased minimum wage of $15 an hour, right? Like that's obviously not Black specific. That is included in part of the Douglas Plan layout that is on the website and was sent to me by organizers, but I can double check that. But we can, things like expanded access to the ballot, making Election Day a federal holiday, that's all in there as well. Deferring or forgiving loans of college students that start and maintain a business that employ at least 3 people within 5 years of them leaving school, that's in there. And like, obviously these are all things that would help Black people for sure, but like those are relatively race neutral or universal policies, yeah?
I would disagree again. I mean, I think some of the most consequential issues happening around democracy impact Black people. Making Election Day a federal holiday impacts Black people because we are disproportionately more likely to be working on Election Day. So I think to some degree, there's a very specific intention in there in terms of wages. We know there is a racial wealth gap. So by targeting the racial wealth gap in that way, like just basic income inequality issues, again, that's something that impacts Black folks. The housing issue, again, a lot of fortunes were decimated in the housing crisis. With regard to the Community Homestead Act, a lot of Black folks are impacted by gentrification. And so entrepreneurship, understanding that Tulsa happened, having the federal government step in and provide support and encourage entrepreneurship among Black folks. Again, those are very specific issues that are very central to the Black community. And so I would push back on that a bit. A lot, and to me, this focuses on a theory of change that, cites, addressing issues that impact Black folks will eventually help other people. So that's where you're seeing it. If we target Black folks and we understand that this nation was founded on intentionally racist policy, then focusing on the issues that impact Black folks, whether it's the minimum wage, which again disproportionately affects Black folks, focusing on election security, which again disproportionately affects Black folks. And by doing so, you also address that issue for other groups who are impacted as well.
No, I certainly agree that that's the intent, and that's, in my opinion, a good thing, right? Like I'm a pretty far left progressive guy, and most things that I believe in are more class conscious issues and universal applications than they are race specific policy. But I think part of Pete's issue, right, is that he's relatively unknown in the black community. So you've all these people who are like, who is this stranger? And then they hear like, well, he's got the plan for black America. And you're like, okay, that sounds great. And then I look at all these things. And I'm like, I understand how those help my life, but these are all written to help like everybody, right? Like you're just selling me on what's good for everybody is kind of like what it feels like, instead of it being something that's like, hey, like I understand specifically your needs. But again, I think that's, to your point, sort of a miscommunication that comes from him being so unknown. So I guess one of the things I wanted, was kind of curious about there is, as far as getting Pete known in the black community, not much of a priority in Iowa, not much of a priority in New Hampshire, doesn't really like need to be, and that's understood. But as he continues to rise in popularity, I think there's a race to getting to people first before they hear the hit pieces and the negative things coming out about Pete. If you're allowed to, I don't know, kind of speak to the strategy of being able to reach those people first, because I think that's where a lot of that miscommunication lies, is like they don't know his intention, and if you see it out of context, it looks bad. If you see it in context, it looks amazing. And that's sort of what the race is for him with black communities.
Yeah, I mean, listen, this is a political news, a political cycle that is unlike any other. I've been in politics for 15 years, and I can think about it in the progression of Twitter. In 2009, I disregarded Twitter. I had a joke name, and after one of my favorite rappers at the time. By 2011, I was using Twitter to organize weekly educational Twitter chats on voter ID laws. By 2011, 2012, by 2016, Twitter was still an information channel for me, mainly to catch news, but Donald Trump was starting to dominate, and he was also starting to leverage it as a means of communicating with people directly. And so if you look at it even from 2009 to 2019, that 10-year progression and the elections in between, things are totally different from where they are before. That's point one. Point two is that allows for misinformation to move much faster than it used to, particularly when it comes to traditional forms of outreach and talking to people on the phone and the multiple rounds of outreach you have to do now because of the amount of misinformation and narrative that people just take whatever fits for what they're trying to do and push it out there. And so something like Pete saying, I'm not asking for your vote because he's there as someone's mayor and not as a presidential candidate, turns into Pete saying, I'm not asking for your vote. And so those very important distinctions get lost. What it's incumbent upon us to do is to, one, just really focus on talking to the average voter and finding the most creative ways to reach them. So, yeah, that's why we'll do TMZ. Yeah, that's why we'll do Black Radio. And, yeah, that's why we'll do The Breakfast Club, because we have to find ways of reaching voters that aren't cloaked in the rapid-fire misinformation that is really the marker of what this cycle is, you know? And it's something where the constant engagement, we're having to work a bit overtime, and I suspect a lot of campaigns are, to make sure that people really understand who the candidate is, what their policies are, who is the primary target for those policies. But people wonder why elections have become more expensive. It's partially because of this piece. It's also partially because of the economy. We can get into that stuff, but we can get it definitely. But Twitter, I think, has both been such a tool. I mean, I've used Twitter to move bills out of committee and the bills that are now law. And to see it now be a place where hot takes are the norm and like nobody's organizing around moving stuff or making sure that laws get passed, it's become a negative tool in terms of just shedding and exposing people. And I think it really undermines the usefulness and what it used to be, which is something that just empowered the average volunteer with the determination to make sure they get things right. To really make change.
I think one of my frustrations with social media in general, obviously I spend a great deal of time on social media in general. A good deal of my life has been in social media management, marketing, and things of that nature. And I think it's It's upsetting to me because, to your point, it used to be this great positive organizing tool, but also now, it, even if you try and use it for that, people are, like, that is like mocked as though, you know, that's not what Twitter is anymore. And to me, Twitter is still that. Like, I still meet a great deal of people from Twitter. I just went and met, you know, 15, 20 people in real life who I met from Twitter and had a great vacation. It was awesome. I met most of the people who come on my podcast through Twitter. It's like, it's still a great networking tool. But then anytime you mention that on Twitter, like, here come the trolls to remind you, like, that's not what this is about. I'm going to ratio you. You don't even understand other people who aren't like you. You elitist and like whatever. And, you know, the list goes on and on. But that's sort of where we're at today. I did want to pivot back a little bit to the Douglas plan stuff. You had mentioned we got right up to kind of to the South Carolina point there. That story came out, and I spoke to Ryan earlier today, obviously. One of the things that hopped off the page from that story for me was that Johnny Cordero, amongst the three big black leaders there who had some opposition to being included, his objection, it sounded like, was that, you know, he had no real problem with the plan and no real problem with Pete, but didn't necessarily want to sign his name to it until he knew more about the authorship of the plan. For everything you just told me at the top of this, you know, segment here, it sounds like the authorship of the plan was, to put it eloquently, black as fuck. So, like, I don't know exactly what he was looking for that he didn't get. And I guess I wanted to talk to you and see if you could clear up kind of what happened there a little bit. Cause that was something both me and Ryan, when we spoke earlier today, were a little unclear on as to, you know, did he never get an answer on that? Did he get an answer? And then, like, you guys didn't get back in touch. And so he thought, like, he didn't endorse and you guys thought he did. Like, how did that come to be that his name was included there and that, like, he felt like he never got an answer on that? Because I would imagine if I, like, random podcast guy from Twitter can get a pretty clear answer on that, then it should be no problem for, like, the head of the Black Caucus of South Carolina to get an answer on that.
Yeah, I am not going to get into that specifically, and I'll tell you why. When it comes to political relationship building, there is a number of different, it's kind of like seesaw. And so we were in constant communication with, I will say this, we were in constant communication with Mr. Cordero. He had multiple lines into the campaign. And so we're looking into why he feels like his questions weren't answered. And I'll just leave it at that. Again, we generally are very forthcoming about how it was put together and who we engaged in order to put together this plan. You mentioned that question to me. I came on the program and I talked about it. There's no real shroud of secrecy around who put it together. I mean, the two primary authors are on the website who put it together. So it's not exactly like we were hiding any of that. And so, you know, I think it's a matter of some miscommunication. Maybe he thought we weren't being clear, and as such, maybe that was something that we didn't hear. But, you know, we were with Mr. Cordero in August, I think was the last time before. In August that I saw him, and, you know, we walked with him and talked with him. We were there talking about our rural broadband plan. And, you know, we've always tried to remain as open as possible when people have questions of us.
The one last question I guess I have on the Douglas plan and kind of the policy formation portion of it is that, I guess, for lack of a better question here, it's like, is that how you guys typically write policy? Like, that seems very intensive, where it's like, it's this ever formulating document. It's going through hundreds of rounds of additions and, you know, God knows how many people you're getting feedback on. Is that, you know, as somebody who's a political outsider, if you will, like, is that how policy is written? Is that unique to Team Pete? Is that unique to the Douglas plan? Like, what's kind of your read on that?
I'm not really sure. But I did find it quite fascinating that they have, you know, there's a robust volunteer structure of policy folks providing input based on their policy expertise and, you know, the folks on staff based on Pete's priorities. We work through those things. And yeah, it's a very, if you notice, a lot of our policies are 18 to 20 pages long because it is an intensive process for us. You know, we're constantly working at those pieces, thinking about, you know, the different angles on it. What have we seen happen in the past? What are good models? I think it is part of the general policymaking process. It's something I saw when I was in working in state government in Maryland. I mean, and that's very typical for people, for elected officials who are very, very policy oriented. And Pete's one of those people, though he also wants you to know his values so you understand where his policies come from. So that's the difference, I think, between them and a lot of, I think, policy want candidates and elected officials. We definitely had a robust process for looking at it over and over again to make sure it worked and we hit every angle we were supposed to, at least with the Douglas plan.
One of the things I think I respect and admire most about Pete is exactly that, is his open-mindedness. A lot of people look at his youth as a weakness. I personally find that to be a strength for that exact reason. I don't think you get to be in your 50s and still working in politics and not be pretty stubborn and rigid in like what your beliefs are and what your values are. And though, you know, I think Pete has strong values, and I don't question it, like his moral center or anything like that. I think his beliefs as far as how you tackle issues are pretty malleable, as to like whatever's the best plan is the best plan, and not, it doesn't have to be his plan. One of the other things I really respect about him is that he also, you know, takes responsibility for his whole team, no matter, you know, the ups, the downs, and what have you. A lot of what we talked about today, obviously, around the Douglas plan and some of this rollout here in South Carolina, the campaign obviously came out, and Pete himself came out kind of taking responsibility, cited, like I'd mentioned earlier, staffer error as far as how some of the things got rolled out there. But I guess I want to ask, how does something like that occur on the ground? Like, what exactly is, like, how do you get from, you know, this announcement in an HBCU paper of black support to, you know, a couple of hundred of white people like buried in that list of names, and a couple other people who, you know, are black leaders who feel like they weren't supposed to be included? Like, what are the errors that go into that? And like, how do we prevent that in the future? Because that was the part that jumped out to me, is it seems uncharacteristically careless of a campaign that is at times criticized for being too careful and too technocratic and too detail-oriented and all these other things. And that seemed very out of character for this campaign.
Well, I'll tell you this, you know, just wanted to be clear about this, right? Because it's a very important point. Mm-hmm. We have never said publicly that this was a list that was all black folks. What we said is that it was black South. What we said was that it was all South Carolinians. There was an error in an email in us trying to get people to opt into the rollout of the op-ed and the rollout of the endorsements, where there was something included in an email. But that we have never said publicly or claimed publicly, and even in the op-ed mentioned the fact that it was all South Carolinians, but not all black folks, and we did not indicate anything else. the second point, to be clear, is that we did get those endorsements of the plan. So there were over 400 endorsements. We have written agreements that folks did sign on to, of them officially supporting the plan. So that aspect is something that I think needs to be cleared up. There was an initial agreement. The disagreement and the miscommunication was over the rollout. Mr. Cordero, you know, at least my understanding is that there may have been a back and forth with him. There may have been some indication he was initially supportive, but, you know, he made it very clear where he stood. And as soon as he did, we removed him. So I'll address that. We also have some supportive language from another person. One person tweeted out, the third person, Mr. Thigpen, again, has indicated support for the conversation. But, you know, again, the real issue was over the rollout and some miscommunication between elected officials. And that was on us, just in terms of like getting it over email and making sure people got it. Some folks missed the email.
I guess that's where I want to push back a little bit, is that like all of those individually sound like easy enough like explanations and mistakes that can be made, but like, okay, like there's an email that cites everybody as black, even though like publicly that was never obviously the position and never the intent, but obviously that email goes out and it, at the very least, is a little misleading to the people who are receiving that email, and then that email becomes public, and it's like, okay, that's one mistake. And then we have people's names who are included who say they, you know, never wanted to be included, and there was some miscommunication at least about like whether or not they were in or they were out. And that happens not to one person, but to three pretty highly established black leaders. And like, those are a lot of mistakes to happen in a campaign that is like buttoned up from the bottom to the top. Like that is the brand of Pete Buttigieg's campaign, is like, we are on the button, we are prepared about everything. And it seems more often than not, and to your point, specifically with the rollout and the communication process with the Black community, those things, that's where I see mistakes from them. And I find that very uncharacteristic of them. I mean,
here's the thing. And I think that's where I think things get kind of really taken, I think, to, because here's the thing. I've worked in politics so long, right, that I think the overexposure of these, because these things happen. They happen a lot more than people talk about. I think this is just a new era where there's more light shed on it, because these are human mistakes. And, you know, I think especially for, you know, we have a great team of folks. We have folks who are, you know, coming into this experience and they're new, and, you know, there are other different pieces involved here when it comes to a new candidate. So I do think that these are the sorts of things that, you know, happen. And I think what's happening is, you know, generally that we are growing a staff and kind of finding a baby colt. I tell people about the campaign, like it's like a baby colt finding their legs. We've expanded, if you think about it, we were 75 people in May, and we have grown to an organization of over 400 people. When it comes to operationally setting up a corporation that large in 3 months, they're going to be mishaps. And I say this as a business owner.
I mean, as somebody whose entire life has been spent in startups and building businesses from the ground up, like that is rapid growth if I've ever seen it. going from 60 to 400 is nuts in a course of like 4 months.
Exactly. And that's what happens in campaigns. Campaigns are rapidly growing operations and they move quickly. And if you think about it, South Carolina is very different than folks in South Bend and the Black community in California or the Black community in Texas. And we're trying to touch and talk to all. So you can imagine that this. So that to me is somebody who has run a business or worked in state government where, you know, think about state government as an operation. That's like 400,000 people. You know, and so to me, because I've seen that, I don't get fazed by these things because it's an organization made up of humans working with other humans on very sensitive issues to humanity.
Now, here's where I do have to ask this question, though, as like, as a relatively young person, as a political outsider, and as somebody who, like, historically speaking, is tried to be shunned out of the political process, right? Like, the thing you were sold on is that whoever is running this giant administration as your president is able to stay on top of things like rapid growth and changes in personnel and organizational structure. And like that is a lot of kind of what we put our trust in our stock in when we choose our president. And so it should give voters pause, I would imagine, if like you see operational mistakes like that, at, you know, going from 60 to 400, what happens when you go from 400 to 8,000, right? Or however big your administration ends up being and however many people you need.
There's a difference, I think, between operational, there's money being lost that we can't track who's employed and who isn't employed, you know, that sort of thing. I think those are to be concerned about. When it comes to miscommunication and perception issues, those sorts of things tend to be more difficult to manage, especially again in a rapid misinformation environment.
I was going to say, do you feel like the age we're in, not just the information age, but especially the age in which we're transitioning out of the Trump era, hopefully, right? And like the Trump era is just rife with people who are miscommunicating things, and like the truth changes literally 3 to 4 times a day, depending on like what station you listen to or what administration official you see an interview with. And so like, I think there's this mistrust of like anything that goes wrong that's currently sort of out in the ether, because like we just want to be able to know like what's what. And so there is this kind of heightened criticism of very human behaviors that I think is kind of in the spirit of things right now. Do you think that's fair, or do you think that's just kind of heightened by the moment?
People are scared.
Rightly so, though, right? Like the world is warming, war is impending, like racism is killing us all. Like there are a lot of things to be scared of right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, to me, I think what the grace and wonder of this organization, I see it as that there's no ego here. So, you know, we are all working towards one mission, right? Mm-hmm. The one thing that, another thing that I love about this organization, like everybody is going to make mistakes. It's how you course correct and address them and own up to them. And this organization is one that we will always own up to our mistakes, and we will always find ways of doing better. The third piece that I love about this organization so much is that they're constantly looking for ways to do better, even outside of those pieces, right? And we, understanding that we are working in an atmosphere where things are crazy, things get, they move so fast, there's a lot of emotion, but that core ethos of, you know, we're doing this for the people. That we are doing this with the best intention, that we are typically executing at a high level, and that, you know, when we make mistakes, we're holding ourselves accountable for it. And there's no ego, meaning no one's getting thrown under the bus, and the environment isn't toxic in that way. To me, I feel like that's an organization that's worthy of being put in charge of our nation.
Well, I certainly tend to agree with you. As somebody, I guess, again, coming from like a tech background, that is always the best way to build product is get all the smartest people you can in a room, build something as fast as you can, then reiterate on it and reiterate on it and reiterate on it until it's good, and leave your ego at the door and let the best ideas win. So it's very much kind of the mind state I come to politics with, and I think that was what I find most refreshing about Pete. So I'm going to leave it there on a positive note, and then we'll come back and we'll do our final session, random people. We're going to do a special kind of different version of that here, but I'll explain that when we get back in a moment.
Who the fuck are these people?
Shut up. This is my favorite part of the podcast.
Internet, are you ready? It's time for random people.
All right, we are back, and we are going to play random people. Now, everybody listening at home knows how this typically goes. I usually have a list of 100 different types of people. I have my guest choose 3 of those numbers, and then I ask the first 3 things that pop in their head about those people. Today, we're going to switch things up a little bit because we have our very special guest, Nina Smith, with us, and we have some campaign questions from Pete supporters all over the internet. So I got about, I think I told you 12 off air, but I think I got 14 here, if I'm counting correctly. I have them numbered by the person, so I got to double check that. Yeah, 14. So I'm going to have you pick 3 numbers between 1 and 14, and I'll ask you 3 of these listener-submitted questions. If you have questions for future guests that we're promoting out there, you can always get at me by DMs, again, at Mitch Gaines on Twitter, or you can email me, mitchgaines@gmail.com. So without much further ado, give me your 3 numbers, Nina.
9, 3, and 12.
12, easy. Where'd 9 go? All right. Oh, these are fun. Okay. You want to start at the bottom or you want to start at the top?
That's what it.
All right. Question number 1 for us. I do not have the name here. I apologize for you. But how hard is it to actually find black people in Iowa and New Hampshire? Every photo shoot with crowd seems to be overwhelmingly white unless it's at a black specific event or location like this past week's at Morehouse. What gives? Sorry to you at home. I don't have your name here.
Okay. And this is with regard to our events generally or Iowa?
The question I got was specific to Iowa and New Hampshire because those obviously they are overwhelmingly white places, but also the places you tend to see campaign photos with overwhelmingly white crowds. So I guess it's in specific to that, but I don't know if that also came from, you know, the Tulane event or other places that I've seen that criticism.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, So the question kind of answers itself. The total population in Iowa, at least according to the last census, is about 3.4% of the state itself.
Jesus. I thought Boston was bad. Good God.
But, you know, what you find in Iowa is a very vibrant Black community. You know, we've spent time in Waterloo, which is a I would say kind of a town where, you know, you do find Black folks there. We had a great conversation with the mayor, a couple of entrepreneurs, Black entrepreneurs there, as well as folks who generally just had an interest in how Pete was going to make their lives better. And you know, there's just specific areas that you have to go to in Iowa where the Black population is higher. It's typically Waterloo, Des Moines, and, you know, and again, as organizations gather and organize themselves, we try to be in those spaces as well.
Awesome. And for anyone who's looking for Black people in photos in New Hampshire, I will be there in a couple of weeks for Pete's event. I think it's on the 14th of December, so I'll be up that way. Keep an eye out. The next one I have here comes from one of my favorite. I'm remiss to call her a Pete supporter because, like myself, she's kind of rather undecided, but I know Pete's within her top two or three or so, at Stefan Sports. Maybe there's an underscore there before or after. I apologize if you can't find her. But of the many questions she sent me, the one you landed on, I'm very curious on. Pete has been very open about his desire for criminal justice reform, and it's sweeping. In my opinion, it's revolutionary. It's probably one of the better criminal justice reform plans I've seen. Part of that is getting kind of like the life after incarceration piece correct, and whether that's restoring voting rights or jobs and things of that nature. So has the campaign hired anybody who has a criminal background, or made a point to kind of hire people who are coming out of prison, or, you know, empower those people in any way as part of the campaign?
I am not at liberty to speak about that piece and our personnel. I will say that we have worked with criminal justice advocates, met with families of folks who have been incarcerated, met with formerly incarcerated folks, and had these conversations. And again, a lot of that stuff, I mean, a lot of their experiences shaped why the criminal justice reform package is so broad. I mean, there's a part pillar that's a part of the Douglas plan, but we also released a separate criminal justice reform plan that expounds and builds on it. And so understanding just how the system moves to almost position folks to fall into the recidivism category. And so understanding those pieces, that's definitely what helped shape the Douglas plan. I'll also say, and, you know, I've been to South Bend several times, and a lot of the work that Pete did and some of the pieces in this criminal justice reform package are influenced by South Bend. Hmm. South Bend has a population, I mean, the median income is in the 20,000s there for Black folks, you know, I'll also note that under Pete's tenure, Black poverty was cut in half. The Black unemployment rate was cut by more than half. And so you can imagine where things started, right? If that all happened under Pete's tenure, right? Yeah. And so
it's not hard to connect those dots.
It's not. And, you know, people talk about the violence in Chicago and, you know, the gun issue and the like. And, you know, South Bend is working within a state that doesn't really cooperate when it comes to gun reform. And so you combine those factors and it doesn't leave much room for folks to get out of that situation, to get out of that circular pattern. You know, and you'll hear him talk about the impact of, you know, the crime bill on multiple generations and generations that are seeing it even today, dealing with the repercussions of some of the policies we've put out there. And the criminal justice reform package speaks to that. And I'll say one last thing about South Bend. He had this initiative that he started, and, you know, talking to the folks who work there, I mean, they're helping folks with everything from bus fare to child support, just trying to provide that sort of be that resource for folks in the community, because, you know, these barriers at the national level and at the state level exist. So, you know, when you have these sorts of restrictions on housing, like, we want to remove all of the restrictions that come with being a former felon when it comes to applying for housing, healthcare, access to a higher education, and there's one other piece. But all of these things are taken from you if you make one mistake and end up with a felony. And, you know, that's part of the reason why we want to remove those exceptions so people can try and at least find a path out of it.
Well, as I mentioned before, it's a big portion of why I support P is specifically the, not just the criminal justice reform plan, but the life after incarceration plans he has. And like, what exactly happens to you when you come out and how do you rehabilitate and re-assimilate into society? And sadly, somebody who's had a lot of friends and family kind of go through those scenarios, that's a very important issue for me. And I think a lot of people get left behind and discarded as, you know, left for dead, for lack of a better phrase. And I'm happy to see him address that. We got one more here. I have 8 and 9 next to each other, and they're both really good. So I will ask you what 9 was, which is the number you chose. However, I also understand as a press person, you may be remiss to answer this question, so we can pivot to number 8 if you'd like. This is actually from a white Pete supporter out in Chicago, which is just a weird sentence to say altogether. But she wanted to know, what is the best reply when people are challenging her as a white person on Pete having no black support? And I think this is an issue that a lot of Pete supporters run into with his majority white support. It's like, there is this narrative that Pete has no black supporters, and then they want to challenge that, but also just kind of look like the angry white people getting defensive and shouting at black people, yeah, I have a black friend, and nobody's trying to hear that shit. So what would you say is like the best reply for people in her situation who are kind of getting that feedback from all sides?
You know, sometimes it's not worth it to engage. And I say that because what we are finding, and I tweeted out this link because I wanted people to understand how important it is. When that happens, it's generally best to just focus on doing the person-to-person engagement with folks you know on the ground. You know, the average voter is not on Twitter. About 26% of the Democratic electorate is on Twitter. If I'm not mistaken, like less than 3% is engaged in the political side of it. And so a lot of times it's very easy to believe that everything that's happening on Twitter is real life. It is not. the second piece I would say is, listen, we generally, the most nasty narratives and I think folks are starting to see that we have our own rapid response approach on Twitter. And we have our own rapid response that we're developing to get our points out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, his name is Mitch Gaines. He's great.
But you know, I think look to the campaign. If the campaign is engaging, then you know you can come along with this. If we are not engaging, then you know I wouldn't necessarily get caught up in it. And you know, it's really just interesting how I think Twitter is a very, very different place than what it used to be. So I wouldn't engage as much. I think there's just a lot of misinformation, and it's up to us to figure out the best way to get at it. And to not erase the people who do support him. So as you see people who do support him speaking up, that's what you amplify, and allow them to speak for themselves. So if you give, you know, one of our black supporters is speaking, or you find a new black supporter on Twitter, give them some love, give them a follow, let them know that you appreciate them. But also give them some space so they can figure out how to deal with the online onslaught.
I think that is a perfect set of advice. I have literally nothing to add. I'm going to leave that right there and let it breathe a little bit. But we wrap up here. We ask everybody the same question, and it kind of lands differently depending on who I'm talking to. But I'm curious, who do you want to hear this episode? We talked about a lot in the past 90 minutes. We talked about the Douglas plan. We talked about your life story and your childhood. We talked about your family and your connections. We talked about Pete and his campaign, and hopefully the future president of the United States, whether that's now or sometime in the future. And so we talked about a whole bunch of things. Who are you hoping really gets a chance to hear this and take this all in? Besides Ryan Grimm.
I would hope that it's the person who has, particularly, I believe, black folks, right? I would really like for someone who is considering supporting Pete, or someone who is secretly very, very intrigued by him and wants to learn more, to listen to this podcast. Because, you know, I as somebody who has come from a space where I've done a lot of organizing, I have worked in government for a long time and have seen a lot of the barriers that exist to the experience of Black folks. I see this campaign having some good ideas, some achievable plans that I think could really change the game for our community. And, you know, I really, really hope that they would have a chance to learn a little bit more about the people behind the campaign, and what this election means to us and why we're involved.
Well, if you're out there listening and you are one of the people, if you're one of these fence sitting folks like myself and haven't made a decision yet, but are a little intrigued by Pete, if you're a Black person, or if you're a person of color in general, if you're just somebody who is vaguely intrigued why the 38-year-old mayor of a town you never heard of except for college football is now potentially going to be your president, I know you're out there listening because everybody listens to Those People's podcast. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. Be sure to check out Nina Smith. Nina, where can they find you out there on the internet besides PeteForAmerica.com?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at NinaSophia81. I generally direct folks there because I like my other channels being a nice sanctuary for me and my family and my friends. So Twitter is the best place, you know, to reach me. And that's generally where you can get the latest on what Pete's up to. I am with Pete and I travel with Pete, so if there's anything happening, I generally tend to post there very quickly.
That sounds like good advice to me then. Follow Nina at NinaSophia81. Thanks again for doing this, Nina. Really appreciate you. And thanks everybody out there listening and supporting the show. Till next time, she is Nina Smith. I am Mitch Gaines, and we are all those people. Have a good one.
Those people are wrong. Most people are right. To want it so bad, you could just put it back.